commando unit was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire...
Celsius Hockey.
Welcome to another Big Fake Radio Show. Joining me, as always, is new Larry, Kevin Jank.
Hey, you. You with the teeth. Come here. Come over here. You know me? Of course you do. That's because I'm famous. Even before I was famous, I was still somebody. And I got respects.
That was a very long quote. And that is a quote from one of the things we watched this week. Mm-hmm. Mr. T's Be Somebody or Be Somebody's Fool. I believe is what it was, right?
Yep, that's the full title. Yeah.
So we'll be talking about that later.
Right off the tongue.
Also joining us is my personal attorney, spiritual advisor, Tuffy.
Everybody's got to wear clothes. If you don't, you'll get arrested.
That's right. It's another quote from Mr. T, maybe. And to discuss another film we watched this week called To Kill a Cop, a 1978 made-for-TV movie, it's our old pal. He's an author, private investigator, raconteur. Pat Piccarelli. Pat.
Good evening, everybody. Hi, how you doing?
Now, do you have a Mr. T quote you would like to say here at the top of the show?
No, you know, had I have known, I would have referred to my book of Mr. T quotes, but I don't have it with me. So, no.
Yes. Well, Pat, thank you for coming back on the show. It's always a treat. You reached out to me this time, and you said, hey, I got an idea for a show or something.
I did, and how many times have I done this over the years? Exactly never.
Yeah,
but I was called by a mutual friend and a friend of your podcast, Miles Watson,
fellow raconteur, Miles Watson,
another one. Yeah, us raconteurs tend to congregate. Anyway, he said there was this movie I watched on YouTube. It's in two parts, total of 3 hours, and there aren't any commercials. It was called To Kill a Cop. And he said it takes place within the confines of New York City, NYPD. And he said, have you ever seen it? And all of a sudden, a flood of memories came back. And not only because I had seen the movie back in 1978 when it first came on. And by the way, it was the most watched movie of the week that year. It was an extremely popular movie. And it morphed into a television series, but we'll get to that a little later. But the movie was loosely based on a book by Dick Daly. Robert Daly was the Deputy Commissioner of Public Information, heretofore known as the DCPI. The DCPI is the liaison between the NYPD and the media. And they're given the rank of Deputy Commissioner. And there are a bunch of deputy commissioners in charge of various things. But it's a civilian position, as all commissioners are. By the way, for those of you who don't know, the police commissioner of the NYPD is not a cop. He's a civilian.
Oh. Yeah. We should also remind everybody that you were a cop in the 70s in New York City.
I was. In fact, I was a cop in the 60s. Oh, I came on the job in 68, retired in 88. I retired a lieutenant. And anyway, the movie was loosely based on Bob Daly's book. By the name of Target Blue. And I had read Target Blue when it first came out, and I was so impressed. I mean, I wasn't writing back then. I was an avid reader, but this book impressed me so much. It was a nonfiction book about the Black Liberation Army and their war on the NYPD. And most of this is forgotten to history. Nobody knows about it, or they forgot about it. Most people that I know, including you guys, weren't even born back then. But it was a very tumultuous time on the job. And I was so impressed with this book that as many books as I've read up until that time and since then, and thousands of books, that the only author I ever wrote to compliment him on his book. And he wrote back to me. And I still have that letter. It was a typewritten letter thanking me and talking about the job a bit. And I still have that letter, and I'd like to quote it, but it's in this house somewhere, and I have no idea where it is.
Yeah.
But one day I'll find it. But anyway, we became friends, and we never actually met. It was email friends, and when email finally came into existence. And then Bob went to Paris to live, and he was a very, very well-liked boss on the job, a deputy commissioner. Now, these people don't do anything, but Bob Daly, I mean, the deputy commissioner didn't want anything to do with cops. They had their niche, they had their jobs, but they didn't want anything to do with the rank and file. Bob Daly was a different animal, highly educated guy. He got this job, and he decided he was going to spend a lot of time with the rank and file. So on the night in question where we met briefly, I hadn't read his book yet. He didn't write the book yet, as I recall. We had a bunch of black nationalists cornered in a building on the west side of Manhattan. And I believe one of them, and I'm not too sure if it was this guy or not, but H. Rap Brown was a leader in the Black Liberation Movement. Not the Black Liberation Army. He wasn't a criminal. The BLA people were criminals. But Bob Daly shows up on the scene. He's the DCPI. First of all, what's he doing there? And he wanted to lead the charge up to the roof to get these guys where they were hiding. And he did it. He went before the cops. He was unarmed, by the way, because these guys aren't armed. And he was lionized by the NYPD. Everybody loved him. And he was so well liked. By the way, H. Rap Brown, if that was him, and I'm pretty sure it was, had the unfortunate thing to get shot in the testicles.
that's right. Yeah, he did mention that.
And he wasn't happy, and he said it was a targeted hit. But knowing cops as I do, they can't hit a freaking Buick at five paces. So just a lucky, or in Mr. Brown's case, an unlucky shot.
Yeah.
But anyway, Bob Daly was so popular that he got fired because he was getting more press. He did. They fired him. He was getting more press than a police commissioner, more press than the mayor. There aren't too many high-ranking people that the rank and file could idolize and respect, I should say. And Bob Daly was one of them. So he writes this book, and it was about the Black Liberation Army. And it was adapted to this movie, To Kill a Cop. The BLA came into existence in the 1970s, the early 1970s. And their reign, I say they probably, the last of them got killed in shootouts or was sent to prison, probably in the early 1980s. But their sole goal was to create a revolution in the United States to overthrow the government. By the way, the Black Liberation Army, and I use that term loosely, consisted of anywhere between 30 and 40 members. So that was the extent of the army. But their goal was to overthrow the government of the United States. Now, how are they going to do this? Well, they came up with this brilliant idea, which is depicted in the movie, to kill cops. Of course, that would have done the trick. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but that was their goal. And they were ambushing NYPD police officers in the 70s. And it was a time, it was so tumultuous and it was like I was back in Vietnam. I don't know. And I wasn't out of Vietnam that long, 10 years. Even less than that, probably 6 years.
That's a lot.
They targeted black and white cops as teams. So if there was a black and white cop, black and white cops working together, they would be targets primarily, but they didn't discriminate. They also went after any cops, but primarily cops that were black and white as a team. And I watched this movie, and actually it was dramatized. They threw a love affair in there between a policewoman and a cop, and the police commissioner was played by Joe Don Baker. Joe Don Baker came to fame in a movie called Walking Tall in the 70s. And he played the chief of detectives in this movie. And the chief of detectives on the real NYPD was a guy by the name of Albert Seidman. And Albert Seidman was a real old-time detective, a cigar-chomping, pork pie hot hat-wearing, swagger, you know, loud, but everybody loved him. I mean, he was what a chief of detectives should be. He didn't care about political correctness. At that time, they didn't even invent the word. But yeah. He didn't care who got hurt. He just wanted to get the bad guys, and that was our job, and we had backup. You know, he was a boss, and he would back us up. But Joe Don Baker portrayed Seidman the way Seidman was. So if you guys watched it, that's the way Albert Seidman was. Albert Seidman was larger than life. A chief in the NYPD had, I think, about 10 chiefs, 15 chiefs. They all got gold shields. And it was very elaborate with all kinds of flags and eagles on it. I mean, it was nice. But Seidman had his own idea of what a chief of detective shield should look like. So rumor has it that he had his shield cast in solid gold and diamonds. the NYPD was a different job back then. You might ask yourself, well, how the hell can anybody afford to do that? And I'll reiterate again, the NYPD was a different job back then. It was fun. I don't know how else to put it. You know, even dodging bullets. I look forward going to work every day. But Albert Seidman was famous among the average New Yorker because he was involved, not involved, he was investigating as the chief of detectives, a very famous mob hit, a guy by the name of Carmine Galante. You guys ever hear of him?
Yeah, it sounds familiar.
Okay, Carmine Galante had done 25 years in jail on a narcotics beef, and he got out, and his goal was to take over the American mafia. He was brutal. Now you say, well, isn't everybody? Yeah, this guy was uber brutal. He was a very vicious guy, and he was whacking people left and right. His goal was to get to the top, no matter who he had to run over. So, and he was one of the bosses of the Five Families. And to kill a made guy, the Five Families have to get together. Well, to kill a boss, the bosses of the Five Families have to get together. Well, actually, four of the five, because one of them is going to get killed. And they decided to whack Carmine because he was creating too much press and he was killing too many of the guys in the families. He didn't care about anybody. So on the day in question, it was on a July 12th, and I remember it well because it was my birthday, and it was a very hot day in the city, and there was a restaurant on the border of Brooklyn and Queens called Joe and Mary's, or somebody in Mary's. It was a mom-and-pop place. Didn't have many tables, but it had like an enclosed yard in the back that had some more tables. So Carmine Galante and his bodyguards, and I use that term loosely, went to the restaurant that day to have a meeting with some other wise guys to talk business. And he was killed. His bodyguards, for some reason, one went to the bathroom, another guy went outside to put a quarter in a parking meter. They weren't in the area where Carmine was killed. They were involved. They were part of the conspiracy. But there was a famous picture. It was front page of all the New York tabloids. And you can look up this picture on the internet. It's still there. Just look up Carmine Galante murder, and you'll see the picture. The picture of Carmine Galante shot up to hell. And back then you could do it. You know, the three major dailies were the New York Mirror, the New York Daily News, and the New York Post, and they were all vying for the goriest stories that they could print to include pictures. So they got a picture of Carmine Galante on his back, shot to hell, shotgun. He was shot with pistols. But his signature cigar, I mean, he was known for that cigar. He always had a cigar in his mouth, whether it was lit or not. When Albert Seidman, I was at the scene, but I was off duty, and I was a sergeant at the time. And I just wanted to be there. I figured this is going to be part of history. And I was like five blocks away. So I went there. Naturally, I couldn't go in. I couldn't get past the police line. But Seidman shows up in his chauffeured, highly polished department car. And he comes out. It was like the parting of the Red Sea. He goes in. And, you know, you get shotgunned in the chest and you're smoking a cigar. That cigar gets spit out. I mean, it's the force of the rounds. The ball bearings going into your body would knock you out of your shoes. But Seidman, in his infinite wisdom, takes his cigar, because he was a cigar chomper. He took his cigar and stuck it in Carmine Galante's mouth. And then he told the press they could take the picture.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the kind of guy Seidman was. But anyway, Joe Don Baker plays the part. And he played Albert Seidman to a T. Now, in real life, cops were getting killed. The Manhattan DA, Frank Hogan, who's known as Mr. DA, it was said that they built the courthouse around him. He retired in his 90s. I mean, he was there from the time he was in his 20s. But he was the DA of New York County, and he was always getting threats. So there was a permanent post in front of his apartment building on the Upper West Side. Two cops sat in a radio car, just sat in front of the building for the whole 8-hour tour. And if they left for whatever reason, somebody would have to come to relieve them. There always had to be a radio car in front of that apartment building. So one of the first hits, if not the first hit, it was these were two white guys, two white cops in the car. But they were a stationary target. And they were an easy target. So the BLA decided that they were going to take them out first. And they just drove up to the car, and they all had automatic weapons, machine guns. And they machine gunned both cops. They both lived. These were Thompson submachine guns that somebody's father had brought back from the war. I mean, they shoot 45 caliber slugs. They lived. They weren't in such great shape. Of course, they had to be retired from the job, but that was the start of it. That scene is in To Kill a Cop. They don't dwell on it. They involve a car chase. There were no car chases. The BLA people escaped immediately. After that, they started to get picky. So fast forward maybe a couple of months, and it was January. I believe it was January 15th, and it was cold in New York. I sound like a star of Dragnet, don't I? It was January 15th. It was hot in L.A. No, but anyway, it's January, and it's cold. I was in a tactical patrol force, the unit I went into after I got out of the police academy. The NYPD you got to call a spade here. It was a corrupt job back then. It was all kinds of problems, and I didn't want any part of it. So there was this unit called the Tactical Patrol Force, and it was supposed to be the elite of the NYPD. We went to where the bullshit was. Anytime there was any trouble in any area, we went, we cleaned it up, and we left. We had no station house. We had no lockers. We used to change in our private cars. And then we would go and solve the precinct's problem. The cops didn't like us because we invaded their territory, beat the shit out of people, locked people up, and we left. And, of course, the next day they had to deal with the flack from the community. But we did what we had to do. So whenever there was a severe problem, and it had to do generally with violent crime, robberies, rapes, whatever it was, they would send us in. And it was primarily foot patrol. And TPF was good because we had a very good reputation, and you only had to put in about 3 years there. And if you want to, you can go anywhere you want after that. You want to be a detective, they put you in a bureau. And we had a very good reputation of honesty and we did our job. So that's a little background. On a night in question, I'm working with my partner, and we're walking up, I think it was 8th Street, 9th Street, whatever it is, in the East Village. The East Village in the 70s was like the black hole of Calcutta. I mean, it was so bad that there was an open drug market on the street where literally hundreds of people used to wait online for their drug dealers to show up. Nobody gave a damn. I mean, the city was going to hell. Garbage everywhere. You know, I kind of miss those days. Oh, but I digress.
Yeah.
Anyway.
New Jack City.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, that's what I signed up for. I mean, I was in my 20s, full of piss and vinegar, wanted to lock a lot of people up, wanted to make a name, wanted to enjoy myself. That's how you do it. Anyway, we're walking down, you know, this is an old neighborhood with tenements, but there were actually trees in this precinct. You know, you go up to any other blighted area in the city, and there was a lot of them back then. There were no trees. It was just concrete and broken down buildings. Here was concrete, broken down buildings, and trees. So I remember the night in particular. I'm walking down a block on a footpath. We are freezing, you know, and you can't go in anywhere because it's your job to stay outside. And we're walking down the block, and coming up toward us are, I think it was three black guys. Now, the East Village was not a black neighborhood. It was everything, but primarily Hispanic. But you didn't see, I mean, there were black families there, but it wasn't anything out of the ordinary to see a couple of black guys walking off the block. But something just, you know, you get a feeling after a while when you're doing. I wasn't out on the street that long, probably only about a year. And something just didn't seem right. My partner was white, which had probably saved our lives that night. But these guys are walking towards us. And, you know, they weren't talking to each other, which sent up a flag to me. You got three guys walking up the street totally silent. And it just didn't seem right. So they walk towards us. We're walking towards them. And they start to pass us. And we immediately turn around. We stop. We turn around. And we look at them. And they continue to walk. They walked about 10, 15 yards, and they turned around. They just looked over their shoulders to look at us. And they saw us standing there. And they just turned back, and they just went on their way. So by the time we reached the corner, we forgot about it. You know, because you have to be careful. We'll be careful like this all the time, and that's how you survive. The homicide rate back then was horrendous, including cops, but not anywhere near what it became with the BLA killing us. Anyway, by the time we got to the corner, we forgot about it. It was time for our meal. I think it was like 8 o'clock. And you got to be careful where you eat in these neighborhoods because they generally don't like cops, and you never know what they're going to do to your food. So there was one place about four blocks away, and I'll never forget the name of this place. It was called Yaya's, Y-A-Y-A. And the owner was a former Port Authority cop. So we felt, you know, we eat there, we're not going to get poisoned. And that's where everybody went. So we're in there with about three or four other teams. And there were other teams that had to stay out. But, you know, we have our radios on, and we hear 1013, which is police officer needs assistance. A lot of screaming, a lot of, you know, officers down. And we were four blocks away, and we ran up the same street we were on when these guys passed us. There's two cops down, one black, one white. Gregory Foster was the black guy, and Rocco Lori was the white guy. Both former Marines, both friends, even outside the job. Young guys, one was 22, one was 23, and they were on foot patrol. And they got assassinated. But the way these guys, these BLA guys did it, now it's bad enough like you're going to die that night, but they shoot your eyes out, and they shoot you in the groin. And that's how we found these guys. And we went up, everybody naturally races to the hospital. You know, I mean, we're not doctors. I knew they were dead, but a doctor has to pronounce you dead. Anyway, it was such an eerie scene. I wrote this in the scene in one of my books, It was the second in a series of the WAGS books, Mike. You're familiar with them, right?
I don't think I've read the WAGS books, actually.
Okay, well, I'll get you a copy. Anyway, the first one was about my ex-partner, James Wagner. They called him Jimmy the Wag. So I wrote the story about him, and that book got published because it was funny. It was a cop book that was funny. I wanted to do something different. I should say I wanted to sell the book. I didn't want to write a regular cop book. So I made it amusing. The second book, they wanted a second book. So I did a prequel. And this was Jimmy the Wags, My Life in the NYPD. And I did a chapter that I'm describing in the book. And the most eerie scene that I till the day I die, I'll never forget it. It was extremely cold. And if you were a police officer that got shot or hurt, and in any way, you wanted to go to Bellevue Hospital, which they had the best trauma surgeons in the city there. And coincidentally, Bellevue was in the confines of the Ninth Precinct, or just out of the Ninth. It was close by. Every cop in the city, it looked like, was there. And the radio cars were pulled up. There was no place to park. They blocked all the streets. People are screaming. And, you know, you're blocking the streets. But all the radio cars, you had a picture of the scene. When the cops raced out of the cars to go in to give blood or whatever we had to do, they didn't even bother closing the doors. The doors are open, and the red lights, you know, the roof lights, they're all on. It had to be 100 radio cars. And as these lights, these red lights are evolving, they click. And that's all you could hear, with click, 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 and these lights going around. And I'll never forget. I tried to describe it in the book, in the second WAGS book, and I did a better job there than I'm doing now, because I wrote the WAGS book 25 years ago. But anyway, these guys were dead. And the city at that time wouldn't even give us bulletproof vests. They said it was too expensive. So, you know, as an aside, eventually, you know who volunteered to supply the vest to the
John
city?
Lennon.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
Yeah.
Said, okay, this cheap bastard, meaning the mayor, won't buy these cops vests. We're going to buy the vests. Only millions. There were 48,000 cops in the job at the time. By the way, now there's only 32,000. But the 48,000 cops on the job, they were going to buy them. The mayor got shamed, basically, into buying the vests. If these people, if Yoko and John wouldn't have come to the forefront in this particular problem, we would have never gotten vests.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but I digress. So we decided that we were going to defend ourselves in the best way possible. And to do that, you had to break a lot of rules. At the time, we were only armed with 38 revolvers, six-shot revolvers, Model 10 Smith & Wesson. In fact, I still have mine. It's in a safe behind me, about 10 feet behind me. I actually cut the barrel down, so I made it the biggest snub-nose revolver, and I still carry it.
Wow.
It was a 4-inch barrel. I chopped it down to 2 inches. I had somebody do it that knew what they were doing, and it just looked like a huge snub-nose revolver. People look at it and say, what the hell is that thing? But anyway, that's the only thing we were permitted to carry. And these guys, these BLA guys, were carrying automatic weapons, grenades, and they weren't afraid to use them. You name it, they had it, sort of shotguns. They didn't care. And they, by the way, there were other cops killed, and if we have time, I'll go into it. But we formed teams. So let's say you do an 8-hour tour. Now, we worked from 6 at night to 2 in the morning, and precinct cops work regular tours, 8 to 4, 4 to 12, 12 to 8. So everybody's overlapping everybody. When you got off after doing your 8-hour tour, you didn't go home. You stayed, and you piled into somebody's civilian car, off duty, no pay, off the books, and you followed radio cars around, because radio cars are targets. I mean, you can't very well hide in a radio car. You know, people, they see you're in uniform and you're in a marked car. So the weapons we got, the weapons we carried were the weapons that our fathers and uncles brought home from World War II. Because back then, you could take anything home. I tried doing that in Vietnam. It didn't work out very well. I managed to get Viet Cong grenades home. I still have them.
Wow.
But well, they had to be deactivated. Viet Cong grenades are handmade grenades. They're on a bamboo stick. If you can picture this,
yeah.
They're on a bamboo stick, and the top has an old pineapple grenade, like you saw in World War II, the pineapples.
Yeah.
You ever see an old hand grenade?
Yeah.
It's like serrated. They call them pineapples. Anyway, they made a mold out of them, and they cast the grenade part of it, the pineapple part. They stuck it on the bamboo handle, which was about 6 to 8 inches long. And in the handle, well, in the grenade, they put gunpowder and a lot of it. Now, the serrations on the pineapple, when it exploded, it broke out. It broke up, and it made a lot of shrapnel. So that's where the injuries and the deaths came from. But in the handle, to activate the grenade, they had a piece of twine wrapped around a match, a wooden match, with a striker in the handle. And you, at the end of the twine was a little tied circle. You would put your finger in it and you would pull it. The striker, the match would hit the striker, ignite a fuse, and it would burn, and that detonated the grenade. Now, these weren't precision weapons.
Yeah, it seems very complicated, yeah.
Well, they said, you know, and the regular grenades we carried, like when I was in Vietnam, I was in an infantry unit, we carried grenades. You have at least 5 seconds before that grenade is going off, up to 8 or 9 seconds. These grenades, you had 0 to 4 seconds. You can pull that thing, it'll blow up in your hand, or you may get lucky. So what I did was I separated the handle from the pineapple and just dumped the powder out, and he allowed me to take them home. But once again, I digress. Guys were bringing home Browning automatic rifles. If you don't know what they are, they're automatic rifles, exactly what they say they are. But they're big and they're cumbersome. I think they got a 22-inch barrel. It was huge. And they got 10-round magazines. You pull the trigger, it's gone. Grenade launchers, flamethrowers, you name it, we had it. But the thing was, these weapons were so big. We'd be occasionally you'd see a car following a radio car with the windows rolled down and barrels sticking out of it. It was a deterrent because these guys weren't going to mess with us. So they went uptown instead, and they killed two cops. The white guy was named Pierre Gentini, and the black guy was named Jones. And it was a fake radio run of a domestic dispute in a project, and they were walking up the walkway to the project. These guys jumped out of the bushes and just mowed them down. Same thing, shots in the eyes, shots in the testicles, same thing. But at around this time, now I'm going to talk about the movie here. They did have the bad guys were black, but they didn't call themselves the Black Liberation Army or some kind of a freedom thing. And there was a woman involved. In fact, there was a woman in the real Black Liberation Army. Her name was Joanne Chesimard. She escaped. She's living in Cuba now, still. They have the investigation. If you guys recall the movie, there were two black detectives in that movie. One of them was a fixture in the squad room. He was always like in and out and talking to the chief. And, you know, he was in most of the movie, throughout the movie, both parts. The second black detective only had a couple of scenes. It was a speaking part. He was bigger, blacker, and meaner. But he was an NYPD detective. And
they even tell his biography.
Well, I tell you how, you know, this guy, this is a little aside, not so many people are aware of this. About the same time as the BLA stuff is going on, a cop by the name of Philip Cardillo and his partner were called to a man with a gun in a mosque in Harlem. Now, you weren't supposed to go into mosques because they were sacred ground. It's a political thing. But you got a man with a gun All right, so what are you going to wait outside while he's shooting people up? Nobody heard any shots or anything, but it's a verified run, man with a gun. It turned out to be a trap. Somebody wanted the cops to go into the mosque because when they got in there, the people that were praying, and it was all men, women weren't allowed, they jumped the cops, took their guns, beat them with them, and Cardillo was killed with his own gun. Now you say, well, where does this black guy come in, this actor, to kill a cop? Well, he was one of the guys that was arrested for killing Cardillo.
What?
Yes. And the deal was, if you're going to make a movie about black revolutionists, you got to put this guy in it. It was like the black version of The Godfather, because in The Godfather, in the wedding scene, those are all real gangsters. And there were demands made. If you want to shoot in the city, you got to have this guy. He beat the rap, but he did it. Everybody knew he did it. But he was in a couple of movies after that, too.
Yeah,
he was a boss in Super Cops. I think he played the chief of detectives. And he was a cop killer. I couldn't believe they put him in the freaking movie. But
that's crazy.
Anyway, while all this is going on, Albert Seidman, the chief, gets himself in trouble. He
gets a suit for his kid. That's what he had did in the movie, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was in the movie.
That was my big question about the movies. What is a charge plate?
Yeah. Well, that's the old school credit cards. Old school credit cards, Jank. A charge plate.
I tell you, you know, you can't take, you're a police officer. You can't take a free cup of coffee. It's against the rules. It's against the law. Seidman, back then the job was totally different. You took what you wanted to take. You know, that's why I wanted, didn't want any part of it. I wanted the TPF. But Seidman should have known better. He took a free meal, big deal, and wasn't by himself. He was with something to do with community affairs, city thing, and he was the guest speaker at a meeting. Anyway, they sat down, and they bought the meal for him. Anyway, they wanted him indicted. Nobody liked this guy for the same reason nobody liked Bob Daley, because he was too popular with the cops. And in the movie, they depicted, as you said, Mike, the chief of detectives' son was graduating school, and he got two free suits, you know, so suppose. And the guy who gave him the suits wanted a favor, and Eyeshide, that was his name, chief of detectives Eyeshide, you know, the guy calls him up in the office. He said, hey, you know, I gave you the suits. He says, now my son has a problem. He was picked up for shoplifting, and it turned out that wasn't his only offense. He had been locked up numerous times. And while Eyeshide told him he would take care of it because it was only one shoplifting offense, you know, he would like give the guy a break. He found out that the guy is a criminal. You know, he's been caught doing numerous stuff. So he tells this guy's father, who owns the haberdasher where Eyeshide got his son's suits, I'm not going to help you. So there's a big investigation, and they were going to lock him up. You know, one thing that was accurate in this movie is the politics of the NYPD. I hope you guys saw that. How political that job business. One of the reasons that 20 years to the day and I was gone. I mean, I couldn't take it. It just wasn't my idea of police work. But anyway, that was depicted accurately, only they changed it around a little so he could get his family involved and his wife involved. In reality, Seidman paid a fine, and that was the end of that. And he retired to Florida, where that's the NYPD burial ground, like an elephant burial ground. He went to, I think, Fort Lauderdale or something, and very revered. Cops used to go down there all the time, knock on his door, you know, and he'd welcome. He's just a great guy. He passed away about 10 years ago, but he was a really, really nice man. So in the movie, there's a big shootout on a roof, because one of the cops who started, Desi Arnaz Jr., Desi Arnaz's son, was in it.
Desi
he was
Arnaz
an actor. He you know, Little Ricky, and if you watch I Love Lucy, Little Ricky, he played a cop who was killed. You know, to go into how he was killed, but it was the BLA guys killed him.
Yeah. Well, he was eating a meal with his girlfriend who he was cheating on his wife with.
they had to put that in there. That never really, you know, they had an affair and.
Hey, Pat, did you recognize that female partner?
She looked familiar.
She was, the actress's name is Christine Belford, but she was Banachek's love interest in season two of Banachek.
Okay, that's, yeah, she, I know she looked,
that was the end of her career, too, right?
Now everyone knows her. Yeah, everyone knows her now.
That was the end of her career. I mean, did she have to do
season three of Banachek purist myself.
No, season two. Oh, well, only two seasons.
You missed the good part, apparently.
But also, Pat, the Jodan Baker's girlfriend in this movie, she was Quincy's girlfriend.
Yeah, that was Joanna Muldaur.
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, she was.
Yeah, Quincy. I tell you, she had a long, prolific career. She was on everything. I mean, you know, back in the 70s, 80s. I tell you, she looked really good back then, and she's in her 80s now. She still looks pretty good. She's still acting. She's done soap operas and stuff, but Little Ricky gets killed, and it's this big funeral, and that's where the showdown is in part two. Now, this is something else. You know, a cop gets killed, particularly by the BLA. When the BLA shootings, the funerals were in St. Patrick's Cathedral. You don't even have to know anything about New York City to know St. Patrick's is a big deal. In the Foster Laurie killing, the one I was peripherally involved in, they had the funeral there too. Now, they were both Staten Island residents, all right? There were so many cops at that funeral. They said 50,000, which they were coming literally from all over the world. There were British bobbies there. There were Greek cops there, Chinese cops there. I mean, from the countries, China and Britain.
Yeah.
It was you couldn't see as far as the eye could see was a sea of blue. So get a load of this. If you know, well, you got to know a little about the city. The cemeteries were in Staten Island. So naturally, they couldn't jam 50,000 cops into the St. Patrick's Cathedral, so they had speakers on Fifth Avenue so you could listen to the service. When the service was over and the hearses left to drive to the cemeteries in Staten Island, we all got our cars. By the way, our cars were parked anywhere. There was no traffic enforcement. It's Midtown Manhattan. Now, you know, you park illegally in Manhattan under penalty of death. I mean, it's just there's no parking zone anywhere. We parked anywhere we wanted, sidewalks. And, you know, nobody messed with us that day because we were in a foul humor, every cop that showed up there. So we all go to our cars to go to the cemetery. Now, by the time the first car had arrived in the Staten Island Cemetery, and this is a haul. This is about 20 miles. The last car hasn't left St. Patrick's Cathedral yet. Just goes to show you how many people showed up. It was so sad. These young widows. In fact, they had a story, coincidentally, today in the New York Post. One of the people who was arrested for the Foster Laurie killing, a guy by the name of Vickers, he got cut loose today.
Whoa.
Yeah, you know, New York State has freed 41 cop killers since Mario Cuomo. He was the governor who got bounced for sexual harassment, sexual abuse. He was a scumbag. Anyway, while he was in office, he completely vacated the parole board and put his people in. We're all progressives. And they're cutting these cop killers loose left and right. And there's no death penalty in New York. Killing a cop is a first degree murder. You have to do 25 years. You get 25 to life. That doesn't mean you get out after 25 years. And all these people did at least 40. But he released them. He's out of office, but the parole board is still there. And they're releasing cop killers all the time. So they released Vickers today.
Hmm.
He was not convicted of killing Foster and Laurie. He beat it. There was a Chinese takeout menu found on the scene with his fingerprints right by the bodies. That was the only evidence they had. The DA said it's not enough, so they never charged him, but they charged him on all kinds of other stuff. He's released. You saw him being wheeled out of a a prison in a wheelchair. They all leave in wheelchairs. As soon as they get home, there goes the wheelchair, and they're fine. But anyway, these Black Liberation Army guys, you know, they had bounties. You know, they're not to be taken alive. And that's when things started to turn around. You couldn't do that today. You'd get indicted. You'd wind up in jail before the but back then, you know, it was you better watch out because you're going to go. And one guy, the most prolific killer, was a guy by the name of Twyman Myers. Twyman Myers just hated cops, and he vowed he wasn't going to die. This guy, he had every possible thing covered if he was going to get arrested. So if he was caught and they threw him up against the wall, you know how you go spread eagle against the wall? Well, he had a hand grenade on a chain around his neck. So when he went up against that wall, the grenade would flop out of his shirt. Now, the cops didn't see because they're behind him. He would pull the pin and toss it. That was how he also had a smaller caliber gun on a chain on his neck also. Anyway, he never got a chance to use any of that stuff because they found out where he was living in the Bronx. And this guy was shot so many times. I think I told you this story, Mike, the other day. I was teaching in the police academy at the time, and the morgue was in Bellevue, about four blocks away. And they said it was a big deal at the time. Twyman Myers finally got whacked. I went to the autopsy. And if you've ever seen, if you've ever been to a real autopsy, you must have seen on television, where if somebody was shot, they'll stick in like a long stick to see the trajectory of the round, so they can get a better idea about where the person was who shot him in case it ever goes to court. This guy looked like a porcupine. He had numerous sticks poking out of his body. Had to be 30 at least.
Well, they had to get him in the testicles, right? Because, I mean, everyone was getting shot in the testicles.
So. I'm sure. When I saw him, he was on his stomach, so I couldn't attest to it. But most of them died. I locked up one of them.
Hey, look at you.
It was about, I'd like to say it was a blazing shootout, but it was actually 15 years later. Got Albert Washington, who was a big deal in the BLA. He went to jail. He got 15 years. They couldn't get him on cop killings. They got him on every other thing. So he got 15 years. He gets out. I'm a sergeant in the 2-4 precinct, the Upper West Side. And what we used to do around the holiday season was put phony wrapped Christmas presents in the back of cars. And leave a window open. And we go across the street.
That's entrapment.
And just wait. That's not entrapment. Entrapment, because they would have thrown it right out. I mean, these prosecutors or the defense counsel would say, that's entrapment. It's not entrapment. It's entrapment if you do something that you wouldn't normally do. These guys are criminals.
You would normally leave on presents in the back of your cars with your windows?
Yeah, we'd purposely leave presents in the back of the car. Well, there was empty boxes. Well, we're not empty. We put stuff in there to give it weight. But, you know, these people, you know, you entrap me. No, you've been locked up 47 times. Trust me. That's not going to work. Because these guys are criminals. Anyway, we didn't know who we had. So we, you know, you can see the guy's walking up the block. He looks in the car. He looks around. And we did it on darkened streets. Riverside Drive was not many people. And I said, well, here he comes. You know, we're waiting. He walks up and down a block a couple of times. Then he goes in. He grabs. You know, they were greedy. Grab every possible box you can grab, which helped us because they couldn't run very far. They couldn't even see us. You know, boxes in front of their faces. Just walk up to them, tap them on the shoulder, and lock them up. So we get them into the station house, and we run as prints. And the CO was in the prison. You know who you just locked up? I said, yes, some guy trying to boost presence. It's a misdemeanor. No big deal. He says, no, you locked up Albert Washington. And he's out on parole. So they're going to violate this guy. He's going back to jail for another 15 years.
Oh,
but New York City being a liberal-leaning town, they didn't violate him.
Oh.
This is a Black Liberation Army soldier, or what they call themselves, soldiers. No, they just focused on that crime. Anybody else, they would have violated, and he would have gone away for whatever he owed. You know, he owed whatever time you have left. That's what you owe if they violate you. Mm-hmm. So we'll finish off by saying Eichheide, the police commissioner's the character, that movie was so popular that it became a series. The Eyeshide was a series.
Yeah, I never knew
that. Did you look and see how many seasons it ran?
I think it was only like one or two.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And because nobody had ever seen Cobb's portrayed in that tone. He was a boisterous, didn't care about anything but his cops. And back then that was true. You had bosses like that. And, you know, it wasn't only cops watching it, obviously, unless they got sponsors and it was a hit. And it ran its course after maybe one or two seasons, and that was the end of it. But anyway, my story and the movie story. Anybody who hasn't seen it listening to this, now you know the backstory. You'll be able to pick out that black guy who murdered Philip Cardillo and became a movie star.
Yeah.
Only in New York. And a couple of other things you'll see. And,
yeah, you can watch it for stuff. You can watch it for free on YouTube. They got the both parts
there.
Yeah,
right. On YouTube.
And there's a couple big stars in this as well. You mentioned Joe Don Baker, but Lou Gossett Jr. plays like the main.
He's the main revolutionary. He was a big star back then.
We also have Rosie Greer's in this for a little bit. Former football player Rosie Greer.
Well, I'm surprised he didn't get an Emmy. That guy couldn't act. he played Rosie Greer.
Yeah, Eartha Kitt is in here.
Eartha Kitt played the Joanne Chesimard the part, but Joanne Chesimard actually killed a cop. She killed a New Jersey State Trooper.
Eartha Kitt's just kind of like the sister of one of the soldier guys, and she's kind of like almost forced into being part of the scheme, I guess. Like she gives him a place to stay. Yeah. And stuff. But,
if you ever want to, I can tell you Joanne Chesimard's stories when she fled to Cuba. After she was captured as the godmother of the Black Liberation Army. She actually blew away cops. And I don't know if it was necessarily in New York, but they also killed a couple in San Francisco. In fact, they walked right into the station house and started blowing cops away.
Now,
part of that.
Now, Jank, there were two Columbo killers in this movie.
Whoa.
Yeah. Did you recognize?
Missed out on that.
Yeah. Apparently you did not recognize them. But yeah, there.
No.
Pat, are you aware of the two Columbo killers in this movie?
I don't know. I don't think.
Well, one of them is Joyce Van Patten, and she plays Eyeshide's ex-wife.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay.
And she was in Columbo twice. Once she had a bit part as a nun in the Dick Van Dyke episode, but she was the killer in the one about the museum and her niece and the belt buckle and all that stuff.
Okay, I saw her in Columbo.
Oh, yeah.
You know who's. You know who else was in this movie? Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso. You know who they are?
Eddie Egan, I recognize, but I can't place. But
okay, Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso were the cops who arrested the French Connection people.
Oh.
Who at the time, that was the biggest heroin bust in the city ever. And they were also in the movie, The French Connection. Eddie Egan plays the Popeye Doyle, I believe the character's name was. He plays their boss in the squad, and Sonny Grasso plays a detective. Sonny Grasso eventually became a big television movie producer. He wanted to do My Life. I ever tell you this story, Mike?
No.
I'm going to have to wait for another time because we're going over here. But yeah, no, we had meetings with them. They had an actor playing me, an actor playing my ex-wife.
Wow.
It's a long involved story, but I knew Sonny very well. Sonny died last year. Eddie died in the 80s. They tried to screw him too because there's a saying on the NYPD. If you become a star in any sense of the word, not necessarily a movie star, but if you make a lot of press, they try anything they can possibly do to get you fired. And that's one of the reasons I was going to lose the job. And Sonny Grasso wanted to do my wife was involved in it. It's a long story, and we can do another show on it, perhaps.
All right.
But Eddie Egan lost the job, regained the job because the punishment didn't fit the crime or some bullshit paperwork, and he died in the 80s. Sonny lasted a long time. Very nice guy. But he wasn't the only. There was a cop named Vito Navarro who was at the Philip Cardillo mosque shooting. He was in To Kill a Cop also.
But the second. Oh, go ahead.
No, I see. Sonny Grasso played Eyeshide's driver. Vito Navarro played one of the detectives. I forget which one.
Yeah, Grasso is credited as Malfitano. Malfitano, if you remember that guy in the movie.
Yeah, Eyeshide's, nope. Every boss from Sergeant up in the NYPD has a chauffeur.
The second Columbo killer, though, was a fellow named Patrick O'Neill, and he played the police commissioner.
Patrick O'Neill, yeah.
He was in Blueprint for Murder, Jank, where the guy's buries the dead body under the building in season one, the final episode of season one.
Yeah, and he makes them dig it up, and then he's wrong.
What I liked about that movie was it was shot in New York. And, I was on the job in the 70s, and I mean, I knew the Bronx. I knew every place that they shot that movie. You know, it was just, it brought back a lot of memories.
I liked it because it had Banachek's girlfriend, Quincy's girlfriend.
There you go.
Two Columbo killers. And it just felt anyway, like, I love that 70s era of TV, you know, just that feel to it. It just has a nice feel to it.
You know, when you look back at it now, that wasn't a very good movie. I mean, it was
okay. It was better than I thought it was.
I was just crazy about the production values. But back then it was a big deal. I mean, shot on location, real cops. It was a huge hit, tremendous hit. And now I'm looking at it and saying, I actually like this thing. You know, I mean,
it wasn't great, but it's good enough.
Yeah, you know, I guess after, you know, you publish a couple of books and, you know, you appreciate art a little more, I guess. Yeah. And there was so many mistakes made in that thing. And
Jank, what'd you think of it?
Overall, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, what do you guys think as writers yourselves? Would you name your character Eyeshide?
No.
I think that was a very good name.
That's something. Yeah. Somebody owed somebody a favor there. Somebody who swept up or something whose name was Eyeshide. And the producer brought
it
in law.
It's like E-I-S-H-I-E. It's so weird. It's just, no, you can't do that.
I can't spell it to this day.
I'm not reading this.
As soon as I saw it, I said, oh, Eyeshide. Yeah, I used to watch the TV series. And
that's why when you told me it's a TV show, I'm like, there's no way there's a TV show called Eyeshide. But yeah, there was.
Well, you know, we can thank Miles Watson for this hour. Because he told me about it.
Let's get Tuffy's take as a lawyer. What do you think, Tuffy? How did you think of To Kill a Cop?
Yeah, I thought it was great. And Pat, my career is police adjacent, and this is the most accurate depiction of a police department I've seen in a movie in a long time.
Yeah, the police department runs on politics, and they play that because all the cops in it. I mean, the technical advisor, they had two, Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso. I mean, they wanted to score some points here. They wanted to break some balls here, and they did it because they showed exactly what that job was like. Yeah.
Especially the way they were showing, especially when you get to higher ranks in police departments, that every one of them is willing to throw any other one under the bus to get one more step up the ladder. And they are all constantly fighting for that next promotion.
You know, this movie's 40 something years old and nothing has changed.
Yeah. Tuffy works with police.
I was forced out of the job. I was on the captain's list and I was forced to leave, forced retirement. And that's part of the Sonny Grasso movie of the week thing that I was involved in. And like I say, that's a topic for another show, but all politics, and it's still the same way. Who do you know? And it's even worse now. I mean, it's so bad. They just passed, not a law, they passed a rule 2 weeks ago in the city council. Anytime a New York City cop stops somebody, even if somebody stops and asks them directions, there's a form to fill out, which takes at least 20 minutes. And you know how many times an incident like this happens during the course of a tour?
Yeah, a lot.
They're gonna take away patrol time. The mayor was pleading with the city council. The mayor is an ex-NYPD captain, Mayor Adams. But anyway, he was pleading with them, don't do this. You're going to cut back on patrol time, response time. He went so far as to take the most progressive. The city council is all progressives. And that's how they came up with this thing that they wanted to pass. And they passed it. Mayor Adams vetoed it, but the city council was going to override his veto. So Mayor Adams has this idea. He took the most progressive out of the progressive city council members and had them ride in radio cars
That'll change
throughout the city and bad neighborhoods. Yeah, well, they would see how much work a cop, you know, not necessarily the danger, but how much paperwork is involved, and you're going to give them more, and it's going to take away from patrol time, which makes citizens less safe. Did they pay attention? They all said, they were interviewed the next day in the press, like, oh, we didn't know that these cops had all this paperwork, but they still overrode Mayor Adam Zito, and that rule is now in effect.
But you don't need cops, Pat. You need therapists and counselors to show up, and that would fix it.
I guess so. What you need is eyesight. We're going to out of retirement.
My other observation is, if you tell a bunch of cops you got another hour of paperwork to do, your overtime budget is going to get blown right out of the water.
That too. Well, what they want you to do is do it on department time, but you can't possibly. In busy houses, like I've worked in busy houses my whole career, all you do is freaking paperwork. You do it while you're working. In between radio runs, you're writing. The way the radio cars go, you got an operator and a recorder. The operator drives, and the recorder writes. And halfway through the tour, you switch. While he's driving, you're writing. And also, you're not looking at what's going on around you. Fast way to get yourself killed. This is not a safe. I mean, about a month ago, 11 migrants made it over our southern border wound up jumping two cops in Midtown Manhattan. I don't know if you saw this.
Yeah, I did not.
They hurt them badly. They beat them up badly. They get arrested. Now, assaulting a police officer is a felony, all right? It's Class B felony. It carries a lot of time. It's automatic. They all got arrested. The cops were hurt pretty badly. They just jumped them for no reason, just to beat up cops. The DA, Alvin Bragg, cuts them loose and told them, okay, come back for your return date. No bail. Cut them loose. 9 out of the 11 jumped on whatever transportation they could find and went out to California. They managed to bag two. I mean, the city, even the cop haters were incensed. How can you possibly do this? No bail for assaulting a police officer? Here's my advice to you guys. Well, obviously, don't become police officers. Mm-hmm. But to take it one step further, don't go to New York. It's a real cesspool.
Hey, Pat. My younger nephew, he just went to the state police academy. He's going to be there the next 3 months or so. But he's going to be a state trooper.
PA state?
Yep.
Oh, well. He's in for a rude awakening.
it's been his dream his whole life because his dad was a state trooper. Even he's a little kid.
If you can get off patrol, but they're required to give write a summons every 15 minutes. It's got to average out. But you can stop one guy, give him 5 summonses. So you're good for the next hour and 15 minutes. But that's what you have to average. Now, once you get away from that, go into investigations or whatever else, then I imagine it's a pretty good job. But I mean, you're riding alone and you're stopping cars. That's inviting death. You never know who you're stopping. It's the most hazardous. That and domestic disputes are the most hazardous jobs.
Oh.
And you're riding alone. They're all solo cars.
There's a domestic dispute in this movie where Vaynerchuk's girlfriend just walked in and said, "Give me the knife." And the guy gave her the knife.
Yeah, well.
And the lady,
you know what the problem there is?
By her husband.
Yeah, she.
The wife calls. She's getting the shit beat out of her. Or one of the neighbors call. The cops come in trying to do the right thing, separating, fighting with the husband to lock them up. Now the wife turns on the cops and grabs something, garbage can cover, rolling pin, whatever. And somehow, sometimes, what they're doing now is these domestic disputes are phony runs. They're not domestic disputes. They just get two cops going up a driveway and they ambush them. And it's happening a lot. It's not, it's not rare anymore. So it isn't a job. You know, that was my one fear. I have 2 sons and, I didn't want them following in my footsteps. I never discussed police work at all, ever. One's a doctor and the other one is in business. So I, dodged a bullet there because I wouldn't be able to sleep at night in this atmosphere with cops. No, thank you.
Well, let's hope for the best for my nephew. All right. Let's, pause.
Yeah, your nephew's got his partner all ready to go. That giant inflatable monkey.
Yeah, I got him. I got him an inflatable monkey for Christmas. So.
Yeah, by the way, that book. Your listeners don't know you wrote this book, I guess, right, Mike?
I told him I've been working on it. Yeah, Pat read the monkey.
Well, book. I tell you,
I don't think so.
It's called Monkey Flip, and this is a YA book, you know, like a, you know, a teenage book. I guess I'm a teenager at heart. I enjoyed the hell out of it. This was really your sense of humor. I mean, I was actually laughing out loud at some of these, you know, these chimpanzee retorts.
That's to the show. Well, I mean,
how dare you?
I tell you, I really enjoyed it. It was when it comes out in whatever format you're going to wind up. I hope a publisher picks it up. But if you self-publish it, I highly recommend this. It was really great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we're sending it around now. We've gotten 3 rejections so far. And as I told Pat, we're going to try and get that number up to 50. And then maybe we'll...
Did you look up Turner?
I did. I submitted to Turner. They're one of the... I've sent out 20 so far. Because it's weird, because they all take so long to get back to you. So you don't want to oversend. So I sent out like 5 here, 5 there. Some up to 20.
Do as much as you can, because the ones that you know, that don't want it, which will be the majority, if not all, because I mean I went through this many times. They say they're going to contact you, but they don't. They just forget about you.
Yeah, they say give us four weeks to get back to you, but you can't just sit around waiting 4 weeks. So you got to just keep sending them.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. At least Turner Publishing is honest. We don't get back to you. If you don't hear from us, we don't watch your book. Well, good. Thank you for telling me. You know, talking about books, before you kick me off the air here, my book, The Sixth Family, is available on Amazon. It's a thriller involving real characters. This is a novel. It's not nonfiction. This is a novel, but I use real characters in it. I don't have to go into it. You can go online and see what it's about, but it's called The Sixth Family.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
Okay. Everyone will enjoy. It's great. So yeah,
I liked it.
Yeah. And we talked about it before on here, but it involves Marilyn Monroe and Johnny Russo.
All kinds of gangsters. Names that you will recognize.
Yeah. So anything else you'd like to plug, Pat?
No, that's about it. I have a PI business. You can find me at condorprivateeye.com online. Yeah. That's about it. I don't do anything else. I try not to do anything else.
But you watch great TV movies. Killer Cop.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you like to do. So.
No. I'm starting on, I've got a, I'm doing a book on Elvis. This is a memoir. Elvis Presley's cousin.
You're going to write that book? Like it's a thing now you're doing?
Well, Turner Publishing has it now. They're interested. Because she had previously published an Elvis cookbook with them. She lived with Elvis Presley in Graceland for her youth. The main focus of the book is on her abusive marriage. She was married to an abusive cop for 34 years, and it was horrendous. And it's good reading. It's eye opening. But anyway, Turner has it now. So I'm doing that, and I'm starting another Ray Yale book. He's one of my characters.
Hey, Ray Yale, yeah.
That. Yeah, I'm bringing Yale back by popular demand, which would be my kids. Hey, you're only going to write another
Yale
book.
Yeah, I like Ray. Bloodshot Eyes and Pop Line, available for online books. You can go buy them right now.
Yeah, well, yes, I know. Anyway, they're online. It's a fiction series about a private eye Vietnam vet who ex-NYPD. Where do I get these ideas from?
Sounds familiar.
But anyway, I'm there online called, just look up my last name, but it's Bloodshot Eyes and the Pop Line, as Mike said.
Yeah, 19books.com. Go there, you'll see them.
There you go, or Amazon. And the one I'm writing now is titled Black and White.
Oh, there you go. So
after the two black and white soldiers in Vietnam who went over to the Viet Cong, which is a true story, and decided they wanted to kill American GIs. You ever hear this?
I did not. I have not heard
that.
It's
true.
How far along are you on the book?
I'm starting to outline it. I never outline anything I write, but I'm going to outline this.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I thought you did an outline. Yeah.
No, I didn't outline The Sixth Family. I just got up and wrote it every day. But that scared the hell out of me, because a couple of times I wrote myself into a corner. You know, I don't want to do that anymore. But no, they were actually two GIs, a black soldier and a white soldier, defected to the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army. They're the regulars, and decided that they were going to fight with them, and they did. They were spotted on numerous occasions, and then the story dies. Our government denies it ever existed. The North Vietnamese don't confirm or deny. I'm making a novel out of it.
Wow, I'm glad to hear it. Sounds good.
Yeah, so am I.
It's looking forward to reading it.
Before. Thank you. Oh, you're the one. Okay, I'm going to put you down for that. One copy to Mike Dell.
It'll be great.
All right, gentlemen.
All right, Pat. Well, thank you very much, buddy. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks, Pat.
I enjoyed myself. Nice meeting you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you met him before, but yeah, it's all right.
No, I think I met one of them. I don't know.
Yeah, either one.
Tuffy might not have been here last time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah. Right. You've seen one, you've seen them all, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Pat. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Thank you very much. Have a good
night. There he goes, the great Pat Piccirelli. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm excited to hear the new book's coming out. Now, here's a thing I'd like to point out. When Pat's working on a new book, he bases it on his own life, and it's about a former New York City police officer and a Vietnam veteran. Some pretty cool things.
Yeah.
I write a book which is based on my life. It's about a talking chimp.
So a lot of grocery store visits in this book?
No, it's basically about a chimp who gave up on life and doesn't leave his house.
Eats a lot of tofu and brown rice pasta.
Which is a lot of pro wrestling. I don't know. So, yeah. But it seems like, I don't know.
There's a whole chapter about him going to get his driver's license photo.
Anyway. Yeah, Monkey Flip is being sent around, so that's something.
That's the title. I like it.
Yeah, works. I really am very proud of it. It's a great talking chip book, damn it.
Work.
Yeah, I am. I'm very proud of it. Like, what have I done with my life? You know, you reflect back, well, not very much. But when you think, hey, I wrote a book about a talking chimp, and it's pretty awesome. So I can go happy with that, you know? Like, if I tomorrow.
Yeah, you contributed to the world.
Well, I got to get it out there. That's the thing, you know? Well, I got to get it out there somehow. So hopefully some agent will be dumb enough to take it. But we'll see. I'll keep everyone posted. But, all right. So, yeah, thanks to Pat. To Kill a Cop. I'm impressed that you guys watched The Kill a Cop, man. Because when I saw it was 3 hours, I was like, there's no way they're watching this.
I was surprised it was that long. It must have been a two-night event.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think it was a 2 1.5-hour deals. Or maybe they did just do it all one night. It was the 70s. So it was a wild time. They may have just been a three-hour movie.
Well, I mean, that'd be 2 hours each with commercial breaks.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Probably 2 hours.
Yeah, it's probably a two-night thing. It was better than I thought it was going to be. I like the ending up on the roof there. And
At first, I was like, is he buying this shit that they're just hanging out here? He's got a coat there.
Lou Gossett and his other Black Liberation Army guy are up on the roof, and they're going to, like, assassinate all the cops going to the funeral. Because Pat said there's so many cops there. They're just going to gun them down. They got a rocket launcher.
And they're going to throw grenades at them as they try to come up. That's pretty scary.
But Ashai finds him up there, and he's, like, talking to him, and they're pretending to be cops. They said they're stationed up there to look out for snipers or something. And Ashai, it seems like he's buying it, you know? But he goes, and he's walking off, and he's about to light his – trying to light his dart, Tuffy. He's trying to light a dart.
Well, I think
a cigar.
It was too subtle, but as I understand, the clue was, because they all have the black band for mourning a fallen officer.
Yeah, their
these
badges.
Two just had regular badges. They didn't have the black bands on them.
Yeah, but he didn't. He played it cool. Like when he looked at their badges. He was saying, you know, he played it cool, and he's walking off. And as he's striking the match, that the lady said, he spins around with his gun and bang, 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 he starts shooting. Shot him in the testicles, I think. Everybody's getting shot in the testicles.
I'm sure that's what they teach you in police academy. Aim for the testicles.
I remember when I was a kid. You know, my dad was a local police officer, and I had to be like 5 or 6 or something at the time, but I remember there was a shooting involving one of his police officer fellas, his compadres, and it was at a grocery store in town, and the cop did shoot the guy in the nuts. So. It does happen. It does happen.
I hope they're in the nut section of the grocery store.
That would be
so good.
That would be amazing. But all right, so there is The Kill a Cop. Go check it out on YouTube. Now, we also, for this week, Jank, it was your turn to pick something. And since we did watch 3 hours of To Kill a Cop, you wanted something a little lighter, maybe?
Yeah, quick. Some lighter fare. You know, it was a different message, another kind of, you know, a story about a black man preaching a message to people, but a lot less violent in this one.
Yes, and I really needed this at this point in my life because, you know, things are bleak. And thankfully, yeah. Mr. T, he uplifted me. You know,
he taught you how to have respect.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never had my life. Break dance.
Yeah.
And how to do squats with popcorn on my head. Those are some of the things you learned to do. But yeah, so Jank picked Be a Somebody or Be Somebody's Fool. This is a 1984 motivational video hosted by American actor Mr. T and distributed by MCA Home Video.
Damn right.
And how would you, I guess it's just Mr. T trying to teach kids how to be good people and how to
be, through his rapping skills and, all kind of fun.
And it's
an
about
hour of Mr. T fun.
Yeah, it's like an hour and, they divide it up into little segments and each segment will have like a little, theme, you know, like, my favorite was probably frustration.
Because I kept going back to it over and over again.
And it's Mr. T in a tuxedo, and he's carrying a big cello.
Yeah.
He's trying to learn how to play the cello, and it always goes poorly. Until
real bad. He's trying to play it like a violin, which, you know.
And he falls over in his
top
chair.
Heavy. Yeah.
But eventually he does play the cello. Eventually he figures it out. But,
yeah, he's a virtuoso, this guy.
Mr. T. Now, Jack, when did you first encounter this? Because it seems like you've seen this many times.
Oh, I have. I first encountered this, I think, in college. There was like a video store on campus that I found this just sitting on the shelf one day. And I rented it, and I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. It was like an old VHS copy. And like, by the time, like after I graduated and once I was working, like I ended up going on eBay or something and buying a VHS copy of this. So I still own that.
Oh, very good. Tuffy, did you ever hear of this, Tuffy?
No, I was not aware of this.
I kind of knew it existed, but I'd never seen it. Jack, not only did you watch this, but it also inspired you to watch another Mr. T program, right?
Well, true. I guess it was the other way around because I was on Tubi looking for movies and I came across this show, TNT. Apparently, I don't know if it's from like the late 80s, early 90s, somewhere around that area.
It has to be in the 80s, I would imagine. I'll look it up.
Could be. So Mr. T plays like a guy, like a former boxer who got framed for a crime he didn't commit. There's like a young blonde lawyer who fought valiantly to get him off of the charges. And, so then they team up and he becomes a private eye kind of working for her to help clear up these cases and stuff like that. So there's a lot of Mr. T like wearing a suit with like a bow tie, like nerd glasses. It's just like, this is ridiculous. What am I watching? But dude, I loved every second of it.
It was in production from 87 to 90. It premiered in first run syndication in January of 88, moving to new episodes on the Family Channel in 1990.
Oh.
Three seasons, 65 episodes. Holy hell.
I mean, it's quite the pilot where he was like, he confronts like this Asian gangster and then he kind of turns around to leave and the guy throws a shuriken at him from behind.
Oh, wow.
And it takes Mr. T down.
Holy hell. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's tremendous. I could not recommend TNT enough. Three episodes so far, and I'll probably just keep plowing through.
Christina Nicole, is that the
sounds right?
Terry Taylor.
Yeah, he plays like T.S. Turner, I think. There was like a funny moment in the first episode where somebody, the guy was like, "I'll see you out now, Mr. T. S. Turner." I was like, oh, I see what you did there.
All right, so that's TNT, and that's on Tubi. But this Be Somebody, it's available on YouTube to watch for free. And I highly recommend everyone does it. So there is a famous person in this show here. Tuffy, do you know who the famous celebrity who was in Mr. T's Be Somebody?
Besides Mr. T.
Yeah, I happened to look on Wikipedia, but I saw Fergie is in it. There's a number of famous people.
Yeah, Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas. Also, New Edition is in it. And Ice-T did the music arrangement for this.
Yeah. We can't get away from Ice-T lately.
2 weeks in a row. We need a new Jack music coordinator for a new Jack motivational video. Let's get Ice-T.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. All right, so the first segment, it's called Shyness. And
well, first they sing the song, I think.
Yeah.
The song
comes. Well, I did cut up an audio clip of the song, so...
Oh, when perfect.
People, it'll kick off the show, and then we'll play it again at the end of the show. So, everyone can
enjoy this song is great. This is the Be Somebody song, where they kind of lay out the whole premise of this whole thing. And it's great, because the kids are, like, singing their little hearts out, and then Mr. T just kind of comes in every once in a while, like, you heard me? Right. I ain't playing.
Now, the one thing Mr. T, like, you just look at him and you just, oh, it's Mr. T. So you just take it for granted because we grew up on Mr. T. Like, oh, there's Mr. T. And he's got all the gold chains and everything. But did you ever really just look at the number of gold chains around his neck?
It is tremendous. Yeah.
Yeah, you would think, like, it's just like one piece or something. No, these are individual gold chains that I tried to read up on this to get, like, how many gold chains or something. And he said it started because he was a bouncer at bars and stuff, and people would forget their gold chains at the bar. So he would just wear them, and then if they came back to get them, he would just give them back to them. But so that's how it started.
He tells you the origin in this movie, and apparently it was not that.
What did he say?
He tells you a different story.
I don't even remember.
He says he's like, when he's talking about roots, he's like, I wear these gold chains just to remind me of slavery.
Oh, no, that's what it became. But as far as, like, how it started initially, it was that. But, yeah, he said he started wearing the gold chains to represent the chains of slaves and everything like that. But that came much later, though, I guess. But, it said it took him an hour a day to put on all the gold chains.
He must have neck problems now.
Yeah, that had to be so heavy. And apparently he quit doing it, though. I want to say, was it Katrina when he quit doing it? Because he said people suffering, he stopped wearing that many gold chains. So he only wore like five or so or something.
Oh, a tasteful amount of gold chains.
But just next time you see Mr. T, just look at the number of gold chains around his neck.
It was like a foot long between all these chains.
Yes, it is crazy. But, all right, so after the big theme song there at the beginning of the movie, or the special, whatever the fuck this is, then the first segment is Shyness. A young girl, played by Janice Kawe, asserts herself by using her temper. That's the description.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, the lesson of this one is, hey, even if you're stuck, act like you're doing awesome, and the person telling you to do better is just an asshole. Because all of her performances were really bad. The director was not wrong.
And she just snaps at him.
Yeah. It's kind of like Rocky II, where he's trying to do the commercials, and the director's all mad at him. Because he can't read good.
Next up, we have Roots. And this is where Mr. T talks about his gold chain.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. T says, you can't... You can't know where you're going if you don't know where you're from, and explains the symbolism of his gold chains.
I love I wear these boots because they were my dad's boots. They're like taped together with like duct tape and shit.
I carry my wallet because it was my dad's wallet and it's held together with duct tape. So, for a lot of life.
And I like that he's explaining all these things about, oh, yeah, you know, I wear the chains to represent slavery. I wear my dad's boots, and I wear my hair like this because my ancestors from the Mandinka tribe, and they wore their hair like this with the mohawk and shit. And then they're like, okay, little girl, what do you have to say about your roots? My dad was from L.A., and his dad was from L.A., but his dad was from Sacramento. It's like, wow, what a rich, compelling story that was. All from California. You couldn't come up with anything better.
And then the kids start singing a song too about, and there's a lot of close-ups, uncomfortable close-ups on little kids singing.
It's very strange. Some of them were really going for it. Like the faces just were way into it. And Mr. T is kind of clapping along, and it's the weirdest clap I've ever seen in my life because he's just so big that like trying to clap doesn't look right.
I guess one of the little girls singing in that, she became a singer and actually had some records and stuff. I can't remember which one it was. Shanice or something. I don't know. But anyway, the third segment is anger. Mr. T tells children to use their anger, not to lose it, but fails to fully employ this when a fly continues to bother him.
Yeah. And he gets a potato salad on his face.
They're having a picnic. And he's trying to tell them, you know, don't lose control of your anger or whatever. And he's trying to swipe at the fly. And he swipes the potato salad. And then he swipes himself in the face. And just comedy. Just straight comedy.
Comedy gold.
Now, Tuffy, how are you enjoying Mr. T so far after these first few seconds?
I'll be honest, I wasn't paying the closest attention to this.
Busting gems? Or what are you doing?
Yeah. Busting some gems for sure.
Hey, Tuffy, how ridiculous is that muscle man Bray Wyatt? Like, why even? They just.
Absolutely fucking ridiculous.
These characters are just absurd now. Like, well, there's no point even playing the game because there's nothing you can do.
Agreed.
So anyway, all right, frustration throughout the video. Oh, this is the one we talked about. Mr. T tries to play the cello. And yeah, this is the only one where they keep cutting back. And like, there's like at least three segments of frustration. That's the whole thing.
Well, that, and then they keep cutting to people saying, be somebody, like even the cameraman. Here's the cameraman.
Yeah.
Be
somebody.
Yeah. There's like a cop at one point, I think. Where they say, be somebody.
Yeah.
Next up, we have styling. Mr. T encourages children to dress up and express themselves. This is very close to being Pizza Hutty or Pizza Pizza.
Yeah. You did say it was getting hot in here at one point. I'm like, oh, you don't want to say that, Mr. T. Walk that one back.
Yeah. these kids coming in, their wacky outfits. They're like,
and this whole thing here was like, table the label, wear your own name. So I don't know if that means you have to make your own clothes, like you're in a sweatshop, or you just take your clothes and put a gold like sticker with your name on it over it.
Yeah.
Which is what these kids should be doing.
A piece of like masking tape and you write on marker, you write your name on it, just slap it on your hip. But
that's going to ever take off.
There are like two girls, young Asian girls who, what were their names? Zena and Zena, but they were spelled that one was with an X and one with a Z. Zena and Zena. I don't know. But they were in this. And then there's
Altadena. Altadena.
There's a
Altadena.
There's some dorky white kid. He thought he's super cool, and he was he the hip hop dancer guy jumping around, or I don't know. But this whole thing is
kind of looks like Rick Astley.
Yeah,
like he's the coolest thing in the 80s. Yeah. Like, I don't know about that.
They're just having this fashion show of these children, but so that's something. Then we have peer pressure. A group of children on a dock.
There's a bunch of kids doing cool stuff, and they tell them not to do it.
They take beer and cigarettes from the garbage while nearby Mr. T shakes his head. And
like a full beer and a full pack of cigarettes in this garbage can. Who would do that?
And boy band New Edition sing a song disdaining peer pressure. New Edition shows up.
No one better to tell you about the dangers of drugs and alcohol than Bobby Brown.
And what was the, remember that Ricky, Mickey, and Mike? What was that thing they would always, that was New Edition, right? Ricky, Bobby, Mickey, and Mike? Or what was it? I don't know.
Probably, I don't know.
They would sing their names. But anyway, peer pressure. I don't remember that one too much.
Peer pressure. I remember that was mostly chorus, and then like every once in a while there'd be like one or two other lines, but they sang that chorus over and over again, and it got stuck in my head.
I watched this like on Tuesday. I watched this early in the week, so a lot of it slipped from my mind. Now this
also the kids are like acting like, oh god, we're all terribly sick now because we had three sips of beer each.
This next one's a little weird. Recouping. Recouping.
This is the best one. Because it's the worst advice I've ever heard in my life.
All right. This was great. Okay, I remember this now. Here's the description from Wikipedia. When a child trips on the sidewalk, Dr. T, in quotes, shows how one can preserve their dignity after an absoluticrous mistake.
I love the word absoluticrous.
By playing it off as a breakdancing move. So yeah, this little kid.
This is an example of being absolute, an absolute ludicrous situation. You slightly stumble on the sidewalk. Like, couldn't you come up with something better than that?
Yeah, this kid's walking down the street and he trips and falls, and like an older guy is walking down.
Laughs at him.
Yeah, he stops and laughs.
Yeah, that
at the
guy
kid.
Was great.
Yeah. So now we do a take two of this, and the kid's walking down the street, and when he trips this time, he catches him up and he does a breakdance move on the ground, and then he stands up and everybody on the street's like applauding, like he's so cool.
That would definitely get you more beaten up than the first one. Like, I wouldn't even normally beat someone up, but seeing him do that breakdance move made me want him to start beating him.
you gotta recoup. Recouping. Who came up with that idea? Recouping.
Yeah. And then Mr. T like comes out, he's like, I'm Dr. T. But they're like, oh, Mr. T, your pants. And he just takes off his like doctor smock and he's wearing like his workout shorts and he starts working out.
Yeah, he forgot to put on his doctor pants. So he's like, oh, no, it wasn't an absolute ludicrous mistake. I was just about to work out. So he takes off his coat and he starts doing squats and stuff.
Yeah. So. It's not like they were boxers or something. It's just his normal workout shorts, so who cares?
He recouped himself. All right. Next up, we have creating a group of children breakdancing it, encourage Mr. T to try some moves. This is pretty good. Yeah. All the kids break dancing, and there's cardboard
teach
down
him
there.
How to pop, and when they want to teach him how to like break dance, he's like, "Nope, not for me. I'll just watch you guys." Which again, sounds kind of Pizzagate.
And I think this one is how I first heard of this video. Treat Your Mother Right, Mr. T raps "Treat Your Mother Right," a segment that was widely posted on the internet between 2005 2006. Yeah, I think I encountered this back then. Yeah.
Yeah, this is all an all Mr. T song, so it's pretty great. It's singing about his mother.
M is for the moans and the miserable groans from the pain that you felt when I was born. O is for the oven with its burning heat, where she stood making sure I had something to eat.
Oh, Jack knows the song.
So good. Apparently she just left the oven open while she was cooking. Seems like a bad idea, but you know.
Yeah, I seem to recall Mr. T got inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. He also talked about his mom. He loves his mom. He really loves his mom.
Yeah, big fan.
Next up we have workout.
Last letter R is that she taught me respect and for the room up in heaven that I know she'll get.
Thank God mother's not a longer word. All right, workout. Mr. T encourages lazy children at a bus stop to use a boombox as a free weight and balance a bag of popcorn on their heads. That's my favorite part.
That fat kid was the best. He couldn't do anything right, even slide down a slide, which I don't know how you possibly messed that up.
Gravity is hard. But, yeah. They're working out with a boombox, and they put bags of popcorn on their head. Squats.
And the fat kid, like, Neil, you know, he just starts doing a squat and just falls on his ass. Oh.
Next up, we have I Am Somebody. Mr. T raps I Am Somebody, as well as offering a few guidelines of rap. Yeah,
this is where you get Ice-T working his magic, I guess.
Next, we have friendship. Mr. T gives his definition of friendship while a girl sings a song about it.
Yeah, this is where the movie kind of, I kind of fast forwarded a little bit. I was not into this song. This is not a bop.
Mr. T's tale, Mr. T tells his version of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet and gives a pro-reading message. I appreciated this. I like this a lot.
Yeah. Go to your library and get a book about a talking monkey.
In the final segment, daydreaming, Mr. T explains how having dreams and goals contributes to success.
Yeah, this one I thought I didn't go where I was expecting it to. I thought it was going to be like, oh, she was daydreaming too much and she missed the ball. But no, they're like, it's good to just sit there and daydream, apparently, because then your dreams will come true. Even if you have to, like, someone's pitching you a ball and you jump up and, like, catch it, chop it, somehow that's going to hit you a home run.
Yes, they're playing baseball. So there it is. It's be somebody or be somebody's fool. I enjoyed this quite a bit. This is pretty spectacular, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
you watch comedy movies that aren't as funny as this was unintentionally.
Yeah, this is pretty great. This is really kind of what Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas should have been.
Yeah. It
should have been, more like this.
But, yeah, that's kind of why I was like, oh, we're going to watch this. We already watched something that wasn't a movie with that movie, so why not?
Yeah, I did enjoy this. And again, it's on YouTube. So I guess, do we rate this 1 out of 10 for, I mean,
sure. I'm giving it a solid 10.
It's up. Toppy?
I don't know if it's a 10. It's like a 7 or an 8.
I'll go 9.
Hell yeah.
Not quite 10, but it's great.
And Mr. Kia, honestly, he's a really good actor because you watch Rocky 3 and you're like, that's the meanest, most hate-filled man I've ever seen in my life. And, like, he's so happy here. So, clearly, he's got chops.
Mr. T. Man. Yeah, good times. So, all right, there's that. And so next week, I think our buddy and fellow raconteur, Miles Watson, will be here next week.
Ooh.
I think I'm going to let him.
Raconteur month.
Yeah, a month of raconteurs. And I think I'm going to let him pick the movie we discussed. I told him, and he wrote back, are you still watching bad movies? And I was like, well, you know, whatever. You can pick a good one. So we'll see what he comes up with.
Yeah.
But I'll let you guys know. I'll check in with him next week. And we're still efforting you to get Cousin Brandon on the show. And because he reached out to me again this week wanting to come on the show. But even though I told him many times we can't do the music show because that we record, he was surprised by that. So maybe someday soon we'll get Brandon back on. Still trying. And I guess Larry will be here next month at some point, right?
Yeah, Larry. It's in his contract.
When was the last time he was on? It was January when he was on, right? So doesn't he technically owe us a February appearance?
Yeah. I got a weekend in next month where I got a go to Chicago again, so I'll let you know.
All right, so Larry will
and that is coordinate. Yeah,
all right, that'll work. Tuffy, also this week, I besides watching To Kill a Cop and Mr. T, I watched a whole bunch of Taskmaster. I started season 6 today.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. What are you up to, Tuffy? What season are you in?
Season 9 right now, like halfway through season 9.
Yeah, season 6, I just watched episode 1. They announced that it's going to be 10 episodes.
So, yeah.
Like most of the other ones I watched were 6. But yeah.
Yeah, starting now, they're all going to be 10 for you.
Okay. So yeah, it's going to take me some time now. But I will say season 5 is my favorite because I love that Asling B lady and Sally Phillips, I think her name was.
Yeah.
Two ladies. They were both great. I enjoyed them quite a bit, but I think that was my favorite season so far. What about you, Tuffy?
Yeah.
You have a favorite season?
I remember season 6 was good, if I remember right. I was a big fan of that Alice Levine lady, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, you know what? I'm 2 episodes in, actually. I'm 2 episodes into season 6, now that I thought I watched 2 of them today. And yeah, I do like Alice, yeah.
I don't remember who was on each of these seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim Vine, is he on season 5 or season 6? Season 6. He's good too.
Yeah. He's like the older bald fellow. Yep. He's pretty good.
Yeah. Season 7 is good with James. Season 7, one of the guys is like real life friends with the Taskmaster. He got a little grating after a while because they're too familiar with each other, but.
A lot of grab asses.
Yeah, I mean they're all great. That's the bottom line. Is there's not a bad season.
Yeah, I haven't encountered a bad season
necessarily, but they're all good.
Because after a while, like after I watched the first two seasons, I'm like, oh, this is going to get kind of repetitive after a while. But they always find a way to make it fun. So
now I'm on season 10, not season 9. Season 10.
And aren't there 16 so far?
Yeah, because season 10 is the was interrupted by COVID.
Oh.
So there's like tasks now where they have in the there's no audience in the studio. They're all spread way apart, and some of the tasks there was social distancing involved, but they're still great.
Tasks should have been like go outside for 10 minutes, see if you get COVID. If you come back and you don't have COVID, you win.
I like in season 5 they'd attack make a water cooler moment, you know, something that people be talking about. And my girl Sally there, she fucked a water cooler. And also got
yeah, I do remember that.
That was pretty great.
I watched part of the first episode.
Oh, just part. And then you stopped? Or you just...
I didn't quite finish it. It's no no Whose Line Is It Anyway or anything like that.
Oh, my God.
Get the hell out of here, Kevin Jang. That is an embarrassing statement even to think.
I didn't really like it the first episode either. I was like, you know. But the more you get, like, it becomes more competitive and ingenious. I will say this, though, Tuffy. I think the biggest, to be successful in the show, all you really have to do is listen to the task carefully and then cheat. Yeah. And you pretty much win everything.
Yeah.
You just take, they always interpret it literally and then just look for a way to cheat that's not on the card. And you kind of win very easily. So
yes, it's also the case that they kind of set it up for you to panic. And there are some tasks where like there are obvious clues that make the task almost too easy if you just look and stop for a second.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm enjoying.
Which is always
it,
funny because then they'll reveal that like as they are starting to show the task that. Oh, you could have done it all in, you know, 2 seconds if you had just looked at this thing. And then everyone in the studio goes, oh,
like fuck. There was one, I think, in season 5 where they had to paint a picture in the dark. And, like, and the cans of paint had, like, a fluorescent stuff around them so you could see them. But there was also a light switch on the wall with a fluorescent thing around it. And you could have just turned it off. So, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah. All right, so yeah, Taskmaster, give it a whirl. It's on the YouTubes. YouTube's got everything. To Kill a Cop, Mr. T, Taskmaster. Hey, you know what else I've been watching? I should have brought this up with Pat because I'm sure he's a big fan. But when I go to sleep now in the mornings there, I've been putting on The Love Boat.
Ooh.
It is amazing. Like, do you guys have any concept of The Love Boat? Yeah. Well, yeah, you know the song.
I've heard of it.
Yeah.
But you've never seen an episode or anything?
I've
seen probably parts of an episode, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it was on, like, UPN reruns at some point when I was a kid, and I watched some of it, I would bet.
Yeah, when I was a little kid there, this, I think it was on from 78 to 86, something like that, 9 seasons or something, I don't know. But when I was a little kid, it was always Love Boat and then Fantasy Island were back-to-back. And
nice.
So, yeah, growing up on those, and I haven't seen either of them since I was, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 or whatever. But a lot of childhood memories, Love Boat. I remember watching Love Boat. But I haven't seen it in a good 40 years. So I put it on there, and it is dynamite. I tell you, it's pretty great. I'm a big fan of Love Boat. Because every episode, there's like it's like an hour-long show, and it takes place on a cruise liner, of course. And people go on there to have a cruise there and to find love, you know. And there's 3 storylines in each episode. And each storyline is written by a different team of writers, which I thought was unique. And it's usually the same thing, you know. They get on there, they meet kind of cute, then there's an obstacle, and then they come together at the end, you know, that one of them deals. But the show is just packed with celebrities, like from TV. Yeah, like,
right.
It is pretty awesome. Like, the other night, I watched one episode of The Love Boat that featured Don Adams and a chimp. It was so great. I couldn't get enough of it. And, like, last night I watched John Ritter was on one. And Scott, young Scott Baio and Christy McNichol were on an episode. Milton Berle on an episode. Jacqueline Smith, Charlie's Angels, you know, she was on there. Yeah, it's just every show is, oh, Mr. Brady from the Brady Bunch was on there. And Florence Henderson was on a different episode, and she fell in love with Pat Harrington Schneider from One Day at a Time.
Whoa.
Yeah, the show is amazing. Oh, and Jimmy J.J. Walker played a ghost, and he was trying to get his ex, his widow, to fall in love with someone else. On, he wanted her to find love again. And I think she was played by Thelma Hopkins, if I'm remembering properly. But so it's just a fabulous show. And I can't recommend it enough. It is so great. And YouTube's got a bunch of them. So, yeah, you can. I'll be watching more tonight. Probably. Well, you know what? Tonight, actually, Tommy, though, I'll be watching Elimination Chamber. Because.
Oh, yeah.
That kicks off the pre-shows at 4 a.m. And I just found out the Kabuki Warriors are wrestling on the pre-show. So, yeah, I'll be the wrestling your girl, Indy Hartwell.
Oh, we ask a cutout to get ready.
But they're wrestling your girl, Indy Hartwell, and Candice LeRae. So,
hello.
And, yeah, so then the proper Elimination Chamber show starts at 5 a.m. So,
yeah,
set your alarms, but I'll be up. And I'll just keep on watching.
It's not.
It will cut into my Love Boat time, but I'll be watching Elimination Chamber. And we got the men's and women's chamber matches, and Rhea Ripley versus Nia Jax. Probably, yeah. I don't know if that's going to be the main event, but because everyone loves Rhea down there, so it might.
I feel like one of the Elimination Chambers has to be the main event, right?
I don't know. Rhea's the biggest star from Australia, and they're in Australia.
So. Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
Will Paul Hogan make an appearance?
I do not think so. I do not
think so. Oh, man.
But,
what are you even doing here?
So that's something. Tuffy, did you watch the rest of Twin Peaks?
Yes, I did.
Ooh, here we go.
Yeah. It certainly got weirder. What did you make
of that finale? Yeah.
The guy with the big hand just punching things.
Yeah, that part was great. yeah, I don't really know what to make of what happened, but let me see. Cooper, nah, I'm just going to the Wikipedia episode summaries.
Yeah, the theory I've heard is that when they go into that weird alternate universe, that's like a pocket dimension of some kind. And that's why him and Diane had to have sex again, even though they didn't want to.
Ritualistic sex magic.
Yeah. They were trying to draw Judy over into this little pocket dimension so that they could destroy it. Just okay. Like how Judy was
Judy, to those couple the same having thing sex as Bob?
I think like Judy created Bob.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay. Like Bob's boss almost.
Bob would be kind of like, maybe in comic book terms, Jack, like Sim and Limbo and Belasco would be Judy.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Or like in the 1989 Batman movie, Judy would be the Joker and Bob would be Bob. One guy. also had long hair.
But then, does their plan work, though? That's the big thing. That's the big question.
Yeah, because then he goes and finds not Laura Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes her back to her house.
The scene at the diner in Texas was great. I did enjoy that, where he, again, shoots a guy in the testicles.
Oh, see, I don't remember the guy getting shot.
He kicks a guy in the testicles and shoots a guy in the foot. That's right. He doesn't shoot the guy in the testicles.
I don't even remember that. But I
he goes to the diner.
Yeah.
He goes to the diner because he's trying to find whatever Laura Palmer's name is down in Texas. And there's three like guys in cowboy hats grabbing the waitress's ass or whatever. And he says, hey, knock it off.
Okay.
Take them over.
All right. I do remember.
One guy pulls the gun on him and he takes the gun, kicks that guy in the balls and then shoots his friend in the foot.
Okay. I do remember.
He put a gun at the fryer at some point.
That sounds
familiar. Yeah, he then goes back by the way. He tells the waitress to write down the other waitress's address. He goes back behind the counter, puts the gun in the fryer, and the cook behind the fryer there. He says, "I don't know if this is hot enough to shoot these bullets off, but I would move if I was you."
But eventually, he gets to Laura Palmer, and he takes her back to the house. where it's supposed to be her
Laura
house.
Palmer, she doesn't know she's Laura Palmer. She doesn't know who he is, doesn't really want to go with him, but she has just shot somebody in the head in her apartment.
Yeah, that was weird.
There's like a rotting corpse with her.
Yeah.
And I seem to recall, don't you see stuff in her apartment? Like, there's stuff on the mantle. And, like, there are all these little hidden clues there, supposedly. And if you see the items.
Something, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. But he takes her back to the, supposed to be her Laura Palmer's house, right? And then she opens the, and she just screams. Like, she screams.
Well, they open the door, and they ask the lady there, like, who'd you buy this house from? Do you know who they bought the house from? And they're trying to figure out if it's Laura Palmer's house. And Laura Palmer doesn't remember anything. And then they just,
supposedly,
I guess it's not your house.
And supposedly the lady that opens the door there or whatever, like, they're the actual people who live in that house in real life.
Yeah.
So I think they're trying to do some sort of thing like they crossed over into reality instead of fiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Things. But yeah, then Laura, it just ends with Laura Palmer screaming though, right? If I'm remembering
correctly. Yes.
And the light goes out in the house. Like it just
and then
out.
Like all the power goes out around or whatever.
So what do you think that meant, Tuffy?
I don't have the first fucking clue.
Ultimately, that's the answer. Yeah. No one knows what the hell David Lynch was thinking.
I'm not even sure he knows what he was thinking.
It kind of like just the scream of existential angst, like the monk pain of the scream, you know, like maybe the reality collapses on itself and the nothingness and just, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, do they ever get home to their regular universe? I don't know.
Cause I think it ties back into the whole, that dream he had. Remember, or Lynch had in the show where it's all a dream. Doesn't he say something like that? Like it's
live inside a dream.
Yeah. So like she screamed and it woke him up from the dream and there's nothing there, you know, like it's,
well, because it was also the, you know, he's in the Black Lodge and Mike says, or the arm or one of them says, is this future, is this past? Where it's like, did they go back in time? Did they go forward in time? Who knows?
That is still the craziest thing about all this, is that there is a scene in the first Twin Peaks 2 seasons where they say, I'll see you again in 20 years. And then 20 years later, they actually do season 3.
Yeah.
That's insanity.
They called that shot like crazy. It's nuts.
I did also like when he goes back to the Black Lodge or whatever and the arm is there and they had already done this earlier in the season. It's just like this blob on a tree and it goes, I am the arm. This is what I sound like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The arm was the little guy, right? Originally.
Yeah.
The dancing guy. And then he became a tree. Yeah.
I think he either died or they just didn't want to bring him back for whatever reason.
Yeah. So they made him a tree. But, So now that you've seen it all, Tuffy, what do you think, Twin Peaks?
It's very good. Season 2, not as much, but season 1 and season 3 are both great.
Season 2, there's definitely the Billy Bean era, where things...
I mean, let's not...
Well, that's the season 2.
Problem.
Billy Zane's a problem. He's a problem.
I mean, season 2 does have some good weird stuff going on, like Ben Horn... thinking he's a Civil War commander for like 5 episodes.
Yeah, like it's better than most TV, but it's not up to season 1. Like it wasn't Twin Peaks.
No.
It was weird, but it wasn't really Twin Peaks. It was, I don't know.
Yeah, because David Lynch wasn't there. It was just Mark Frost at the point.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you haven't seen Twin Peaks though, you should. Lord knows we've talked about it enough on this show over the years.
Yeah. So. And it was nice that Cooper made a new Dougie Jones to send back to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Now, I think, you know, because that was our gimmick where we watched Twin Peaks episodes on the show. I think we should start doing that with The Love Boat. Because there are 250 episodes of The Love Boat.
Ooh.
So that would take us.
Oh, boy. Well. The rest of our lives.
I'll be honest. Listening to you and Jank and Pat talk about who from Columbo was on To Kill a Cop.
Yeah, that was interesting.
I know there's going to be crossover between The Love Boat and Columbo.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any Columbo crossover that I've noticed. There has to be some eventually. Like Peter Falk's got to show up.
Walter McGowan's got to be in at least like 12 episodes.
Yeah. Cause of course Captain Stu being on the Love Boat, he was Murray Slaughter on the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And the doc on there was Bernie Capella. He played Siegfried on Get Smart. So, you know,
this is why we can't do the Love Boat, because it is going to be just an hour of Mike Fell saying, and this person was also on this TV show from the 1970s.
I fucking love it.
So, like Banachek's landlord.
There's also, not really. The other great thing about Love Boat, there's at least two or three smoking hot ladies in every episode of the Love Boat. It is amazing. Yeah. So, the other night, Charo was on. You guys know Charo?
Hoochie Coochie. Yeah. Coochie.
Yes, that's right. How do you know Charo? I didn't think
Charo was still hanging around enough, I think, when Cenk and I were young people, that she would show up as
a pop culture reference. She was on the Pee Wee's Christmas special.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Stuff like that, yeah.
It would be a thing that, like, Conan or The Simpsons would have referenced at some point, I bet.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Because, we all grew up on Charo on the Love Boat. So that's how we know Charo.
Yeah, like the writers, the comedy shows that I was watching, the writers for those were probably the same age as you, Mike Dell, so they had all these same references that you had, and I had no idea what they were talking about when I was a kid.
Good times. So, what else? Jack, what were you watching this week?
Well, besides TNT, I watched Dinner in America.
Dinner in America. I don't know what that
is. Yeah. This is a movie that came out last year. I've been hearing a lot about it on this film podcast I listened to. And then Red Letter Media did a review of it like a week ago. So I'm like, I gotta watch this thing. And luckily it was on Hulu, so I didn't have to like do anything special to watch it. But it's pretty good. It's got that Kyle Gallner guy who Red Letter Media did a whole retrospective on a bunch of his movies last year.
Wait, what?
I've never been a big fan of him. Really? He played like The Flash on like the Smallville show. He was like one of the people in the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot that was terrible.
Not helping me. Was he ever on the Love Boat?
Basically,
he was basically a working actor in low budget films these days.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But this was a very good film. I will give it that. He plays like he's secretly the lead singer of a punk rock band. Like he wears a ski mask on stage. Nobody knows his real identity or anything like that. But he kind of runs into this girl who's like his biggest fan, apparently. And, she's way into them. She's been sending like, photos of her vagina to him for a bunch of years now. Like she'll listen to their music and like masturbate and then send pictures to him, like little Polaroid pictures.
I've been doing this show for 15 years. That's never happened to me. <I know. laughs> Hey, Mars Argo is in this movie. Doesn't Larry like Mars Argo?
The hell's Mars Argo?
She's sick, right? Isn't she?
Is she the girl? Like, does she have glasses and stuff like
She's not the main girl. I think the main girl is Emily Skeggs. Mars Argo plays Sissy. And Mary Lynn Raskscub is also in this. She was on Mr. Show. Oh, Leah Thompson's in this.
Yeah, she is. Small part, but yeah, she was there.
All right.
So yeah, he kind of runs into her and they have this kind of unlikely love story. Apparently he was in some class that she took at one point. But I don't know, she's supposed to be 20. He's got to be at least like 40 at this point. Like, he was on Smallville back in the day, so like, he's got to be pretty up there.
Speaking of that age difference real quick, Jaromir Jagr had his number retired here in Pittsburgh this week. And it was a big deal because everybody loves Jagr. And his first time back in Pittsburgh. And he's giving a speech. He's like 52, you know. And he's got his girlfriend and his mother there. And his girlfriend is a goddamn rocket. All right? and holy hell. And when he's giving his speech, he's like, I think her name's like, I'll call her Debbie. And he says, I want to thank Debbie because I know she's too young to remember when I played in Pittsburgh. the age difference is a thing.
Real snipe selling, boys.
So, all right. So this guy's like 40. She's like 20. And go ahead.
Yeah, but they meet up and he kind of like he burned down some other people's house and then like he's kind of on the run. So he kind of hides out with her and like kind of gets in with her and her family. And it's just kind of this unlikely love story, like a very small indie film of him kind of giving her confidence as they go along. And, you know, she kind of starts to realize who he is. Like, he tells her eventually who he is. And, you know, he eventually goes, ends up going to jail, but like they kind of still stay.
wait.
Starts her own like band.
Why does he go to jail?
Well, because he burned down the house at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, right.
They catch up to him. Yeah.
So, all right. So the whole time, cool. The whole time they were like falling in love, she did not know he was the punk rock singer.
No, she did
but
not
he
know.
Had, but at that point, he had already seen her vagina.
Yes. That's all it took for him to be in, I guess. But it's pretty cool. Like, there's a part where she starts singing, like, they kind of start doing a song together, and then, like, she starts becoming a lead singer of another band after he goes to jail and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool. She kind of, like, finds herself through this whole thing, and it's fun. I enjoyed it.
It's on the Hulu. It gets a 7.3 on IMDb and a 91 on Rotten Tomatoes. So.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
All right.
So I watched that. And then, of course, I've been still watching Cheers.
Hey, what are you on Cheers? Did you finish season 5?
I did. I'm on probably like 6 or maybe 5 or 6 episodes into season 6.
All right.
So
you've seen
they finally got rid of those
already.
Stupid uniforms.
Oh, those were great. I love that when they had the uniforms. And but I love the first episode there. Sam comes back and screaming Viking. And I'll take a screaming Viking.
Yeah.
Remember that? That was great. Yeah. Would you like the cucumber bruised? Yeah, slightly. Yeah.
Screaming Viking. Screaming Viking.
Fucking love Cheers.
Yeah. It's weird not, you know, having Sam not own the bar now. It's very strange.
But it's great though, the way because you keep a show on like 11 years or whatever it was, you gotta change it up, you know? It's like a wrestling guy, you gotta reinvent yourself, and it completely reinvented the show by him not owning it and working his way back up. So now
it's kind of like those later Office seasons though, where it's like, oh yeah, now this is happening, or Robert California's here.
But yeah, Sam's goal is to get the bar back. Eventually he does get the bar back though. So
yeah, I looked that up already. I was like, I need to know when he gets it back.
Not too late though.
By the end of the show.
Yeah, not too late.
Like season 8, I think.
I'm trying to think, 6? Season 6 is like Evan Drake, right? He's her love interest.
Oh, is he the boss? Yeah, he hasn't shown up yet. Like, he was supposed to come to Carla's wedding, but he didn't.
Okay, yeah, he's the big corporate guy who Rebecca's in love with.
Yeah.
And then season 7, is Robin Colcord already in season 7, or is that season 8? That might be season... Yeah, I'm blending together. But yeah, he gets the bar back around 8 or 9, somewhere around there, I guess. But because he gets the bar back when he turns in Colcord. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I think I saw that. Yeah. That he turns narcs on somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a different different dynamic for sure. Especially when the season starts out where like Norm and Cliff aren't even showing up anymore.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. So weird.
Eddie LeBeck. Did they get married?
Yeah, they just got married. Yep.
Yeah.
That was a good one. Like, we finally have to let somebody get married on this show after promising it so many times.
You haven't seen Eddie become a penguin yet, have you?
No.
Yeah, because he calls and he, you know, he's out of work, you know?
Yeah, the wedding money, he got let it go. Yeah.
Let go by the Bruins. So he calls up and I think he leaves a message for Carla and what he gets. And he says, hey, Eddie's a penguin. And she's like, oh, that's awesome. They have a good young team, the coolest uniforms in the league. And he shows up and he's dressed up as an actual penguin. He's like in the Ice Capades, you know? And and Woody sees him and he goes, oh, are their home uniforms that cool too? good times. All right. Yeah, good on you for watching Cheers. Tuffy, that's what you're going to do next, all right? You're going to watch Cheers.
Okay. No.
I watched Taskmaster. Come on.
Good time.
Come on, Tuffy.
Cheers is fine.
Yeah, I mean, I watched other stuff this week that wasn't Cheers.
All right,
that was a plus.
What'd you watch?
I watched 2 movies.
Neither of them are like new, but I watched Midsommar.
Oh, yeah.
We
talked about that. I watched that during my 11 movie deals, right? I remember we talked about
that.
Midsommar.
Yeah, so I kind of knew, like, what was going to happen going into it, but, like, the actors aren't great, I would say.
I thought Pugh did a good job, right? That was Florence Pugh, right?
Yeah?
Yeah.
But the rest of it was like, eh.
I'm with fine. You. Like, didn't Larry love it, or I think someone loved it? I don't know.
That could be. I mean, the public seems to love it. Like, it gets high ratings and stuff. Yeah. But yeah.
I guess thought it was fine.
Cool if they made a horror movie set mostly during the day, but other than that, like, yeah. It's not that great. It's kind of me.
I guess six. Yeah. Six, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was fine. And then I watched Citizen Kane.
Wait. Oh, you've never seen Citizen Kane?
No.
So this is is it just a movie you discovered recently? Like, oh, I should give it, or like, you know,
no,
Citizen Kane,
aware.
Right?
So, I was aware of Citizen Kane. I just had not seen Citizen Kane.
Yeah. So what'd you think?
It's awesome. That's a great movie.
Right. It is. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I knew the spoiler going in. I knew what Rosebud was before I saw the movie, but,
do you know what Rosebud really was though? Like, not in the movie, but why, Orson Welles called it Rosebud?
Something to do with William Randolph Hearst, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it was the nickname he had for his mistress's vagina.
There you go.
So, Rosebud. Citizen Kane. It is great.
Yeah, that movie's awesome.
There is a man, a certain man. Yes, yeah, Charles Foster Kane. So good. Hey, how about this? Hey, remember, Jank, you remember that episode of Columbo where that guy was like movie memorabilia and he had the gate for Charles Foster Kane's estate?
Well, yep. I do remember it.
I can tie anything back to Columbo, Tuffy.
Yeah.
6 degrees of Columbo.
Citizen Kane. I imagine everyone.
Yeah, because,
Tuffy, but
like, yeah. There have been plenty of times where I'm like, oh, I need to watch Citizen Kane at some point. I need to see Citizen Kane. And I know I've checked over the years, like, is this streaming somewhere since streaming became a thing? And it never was. And I just pulled up HBO this week and, it was just added to HBO or whatever. It's like, well, shit, I got to watch it now.
They called my bluff.
Yeah. See, maybe we should do this, right? I just pick an old movie that I know you guys have never seen. And then I'll educate you on the fine arts.
Seen old movies. This isn't like, I've never watched movies from the
40s. I'm guessing you haven't seen many old movies. Like, I'm guessing you haven't. You say you have. And how many Humphrey Bogart movies?
Probably not as many as Mike Dell. Probably a lot that Mike Dell has seen I haven't seen, but.
Like, how many Cary Grant movies have you seen?
I don't know. One or two?
Yeah, see, you're missing out on a lot of stuff.
Let's see.
It wasn't on Columbo, not watched.
But.
I feel like I've seen North by Northwest, but I can't say for sure that I've seen North by Northwest.
Well, if you've seen it, you know.
I've seen scenes from it.
You saw it in the theater?
And that's the kind of movie.
Yeah, a couple years ago. Huh. It was one of those, like, Fathom events. I was like, all right, I'll go check this out. Pretty good.
Yeah, right. Definitely, because my friends in college and high school were, like, film nerd kind of people. And this was definitely the kind of movie that we would have watched, but I probably just, like, fell asleep during it or something.
Before I got hardcore into literature and I started reading everything, I watched old movies, and I watched them all. Like, because back in my day, AMC was actually a good movie channel, and they actually just they showed nothing but old movies. So
I was 100 Bogart movies,
like Breaking Bad.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, I've seen Casablanca, so that's one Humphrey Bogart movie.
There you go. At least you've seen Casablanca. What about Rear Window? Have you ever seen Rear Window, Jimmy
Smith? Again, that and North by Northwest, where it's like, I've seen scenes from it and parodies of scenes from it. I don't think I've
seen
the
Simpsons episode.
And the whole Simpsons episode.
Like,
yeah.
Bart, your epidermis is showing.
Plus, any Jimmy Stewart movie, it's like, I've seen so many people do Jimmy Stewart impressions, I've pretty much seen everything he's ever done.
Jimmy Stewart is great. Probably my three favorite actors are Paul Newman, Jimmy Stewart, and Cary Grant, probably. They're great in anything they do.
Yeah.
Have you seen Mr. T?
I have seen Mr. T. Hey, Jake, I actually have a Mr. T comic book. I remember purchasing it, but it was in the 1990s, though, so we can't do it on Flea Market Fantasy.
Oh, yeah, but Mr. T and the T-Force.
Mr. T and the T-Force. I still have, like, issue one. I think I still have it down there bagged with, you know, like, it came in a cellophane bag, and it's unopened in that bag down there. So I'm sure that's worth thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I've also seen His Girl Friday is another Cary Grant movie I've seen.
That's a great movie, yeah, Rosalind Russell, man.
Yeah.
Working a newspaper. The dialogue is very
quick.
That's on
Tubi for free right now.
Yeah. At least snappy dialogue in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Maltese Falcon's on Tubi. Mike Dell, you got a treasure trove probably waiting for you there.
I know.
North by Northwest is on Tubi.
Holy hell. What are we doing watching all these terrible movies on Tubi with all these classics? I had no idea Tubi had all these great movies on there. We've gone through the Civil Danning catalog, but you still. Right. We'll see what Miles picks for next week. But all right, is there anything else to discuss on this week's Fake Radio Show?
Probably not.
I don't think so. Do we want to do a preview of Elimination Chamber?
Sure. I guess Rhea beats Nia. You know, she's going to keep that belt.
Yeah.
Who comes out of the men's chamber match there, Tubby?
I feel like Drew or maybe LA Knight.
Yeah, I guess the premise is that whoever wins this is going to face Seth Rollins at WrestleMania. But
yeah.
It seems a lot of that seems questionable. I don't know what they're doing. So.
Yeah, I don't know that it's for sure that Seth will be back by WrestleMania. Is another part of it?
They're acting like he will be, so I don't know. But, yeah, I think Drew should win it. He's doing great work right now, so, yeah, he should be the guy.
I'm assuming the Judgment Day retains against Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate.
I should hope so. I should hope so.
And the Kabuki Warriors presumably.
Yeah, they're not dropping the titles on a kickoff show. So don't worry about that.
Yeah, that was just to give Indy Hartwell a hometown match, I'm assuming.
Yeah, Candice LeRae is going to be eating that pin. Yep. So.
And then the Women's Elimination Chamber, which is Becky or Bianca, I would imagine.
It's got to be Becky, right? Because they had Becky and Rhea face off at that, you know, thing they did with The Rock and Cody and all that.
Yeah.
And Becky's their biggest star outside of.
That there are three people that I could see winning and four that would be plausible winning, like Naomi and Tiffany Stratton. They're not winning that. I know that.
No, but Tiffany's great. I love Tiffany.
Yeah. Her and Liv wrestled tonight, and that was a fantastic match.
Yeah, I did catch that, actually. Yeah, I did see that before the show.
Like Raquel, it would be plausible that she could win, but storyline-wise, she's not winning. And then Liv, Bianca, Becky are all big enough that I don't think people would complain if they won.
Yeah, I think I'm glad Raquel's back. She came back last week. Jank was thrilled. He loves Raquel.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's nice. I guess that thing she was dealing with, that whatever they called it, where she's having like allergic reactions to everything. She says she still has to deal with it, you know, but she's doing a lot better. So it's good to see her back. Yeah, I think it's got to be Becky. It's got to be Becky.
Yeah.
So, all right. I guess that's it. Those are all the matches?
Yeah.
Huh. All right.
I guess two Elimination Chambers is supposed to kill some time.
Yeah. And all right.
Assuming
well,
the chamber gets to Australia. They had to reroute it, I saw.
Yeah, they're worried about pirates.
Yeah.
Ours, should be there. So, all right. Flea Market Fantasy. What do we got over there, Jank? Shazam is up there.
Shazam.
And then we recorded one last night. Oh, Power Girl.
Yeah. Thrilling issue. Be sure you tune in for that one.
If you ever
want to hear about spreadsheets.
Yeah. If you ever wanted to see Power Girl go to work and talk to her neighbors. This issue is thrilling.
You like people named Garth McGarth. This is the book for you.
So that's something to look forward to. Next week, like I said, Miles Watson should be here. And I think that's it. So we got to thank Pat Piccarelli.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who else?
He can tell a story, that's for sure.
Yeah, I didn't have to do much at all this show.
No.
I just handed the football off to him, and he took it. Not too much at all.
He's your Travis Kelce.
So thanks to Pat. And, be on the lookout for Monkey Flip anywhere from 3 to 8 years. It should be out there sometime. So, by the time I hear from agents and everything. So, all right. Thanks to Tuffy. Thanks to Jank. And until next week, pass the Munchichi, Governor Gabby.
Thank you very much.